Hello, how are you doing, Dr. Tennant?
Okay, I'm here. Okay, all ready.
Good. So, for the audience listening, I want to say again, hello and welcome to a very special Daily Remedy podcast. Today, we are going to be interviewing the incredible Dr. Forrest Tennant. And before we begin, let me give a quick introduction on Dr. Tennant so that those of you who are not familiar with him are better acquainted with his accomplishments. Dr. Tennant is not only a physician who led the way on pain management and substance use dependency. He is also the author of many writings, including The Strange Medical Saga of Elvis Presley. He has done political advocacy, and he has served as a business consultant for many healthcare organizations. And he really, in many ways, pioneered the concept of patient advocacy before that even became a buzzword in today's healthcare. And so with that, I'd like to open up and ask Dr. Tennant, really just what led you and what is it unique about you that led to such a successful and diverse career?
Well, first off, Darsh, I started off as I still claim to be an internist, but I spent my early career in the Army and in the Public Health Service. And I somewhere along the line, I just developed one philosophy, I guess, or one attitude, and that was you should always be looking at what the new public health issues of the day happen to be. Like I remember the days in my early career, it might surprise you, but I was very involved with sexually transmitted diseases, mental retardation, family planning, and in the early days of my own public health career. And so as time has moved forward, you have different public health issues come up. And I actually developed my interest in addiction and pain back when I was an Army surgeon during the Vietnam War. And I've maintained those things, but despite all the controversies, society really is, and the medical profession really is, grappling with these issues in their usual way, a little controversy here, a little start here, a little backward flow here. But what's been changed today is the computer and media, and you're part of it. I mean, the program you're putting on here today, for example, is the new way of communicating. So health education is what it's all about. Always has been and always will be. And the only thing is that means are different. During the Revolutionary War, they carried messages on horseback. Today, we're carrying them like today. I mean, here we're doing this podcast, which is an amazing thing when you stop and think about where we were 30, 40 years ago, where it's strictly written and strictly journals and newspapers. And today, we're able to bring education in a much better, much more targeted, much more refined way. So all I have done is try to keep up with the ways to communicate, although I'll be the first to tell you that the technology of the day has found a lot of resistance in me because I'm not very technologically oriented, but that's what people look at today. I mean, we all know this. Everybody is, you can't go to a restaurant, you can't go to a store, you can't go anywhere without people taking a look at their phone. And so this is the way where people are going to get information. And so I developed issues with arachnoiditis, and now the other great clinical interest is the genetic connective tissue collagen disorders. The only thing that's different is how we communicate.
Sure. Let me ask you a little bit about that because I think that's a very interesting issue. Arachnoiditis, for the audience, is a rare but extremely debilitating chronic pain condition caused by what's known as the arachnoid layer of the spinal cord. It's certain layers of tissue that encompass the overall spinal cord. And in managing those patients, you really are focusing on patient functionality, quality of life. Dr. Tennant, in your vast experience, you alluded to the changing role of technology, but you must have also seen certain patterns that come and go over time as well. For example, how we look at social health issues, how we look at public policy issues. Are there anything that is seen, is perceived to be new, but for you seems like it's just an old hat reformatted? Essentially what I'm asking, are you starting to see recurring patterns in your experience that while technology may be different, it's still the same fundamental issue?
Yes. Let me talk about a technological issue which is not talked about, but really ties in with arachnoiditis, and that is all new things have their downsides. And one of the downsides of new technology is that people are now overly sedentary. We're all sitting around too much. The average person today spends several hours a day sitting in front of a screen. We sit in cars, we sit in planes, we sit before television, we sit before a computer, and frankly, it has been the decrease in standing activity, if you will, that has actually led to a great extent the epidemic, if you want to call it that, or at least the rise in prevalence of arachnoiditis. And so, from a public health issue, we humans are oversitting. That probably applies to all of us, because our bodies are really made to stand a great deal of the day. We're only made to lay down no more than about 8 hours during the day, and the rest of the time, most of the time, standing, not sitting. So that's been a problem, and it has had a great effect on our spines. And so spinal disease has emerged as the number one new public health medical issue of the day. And a lot of that has to do with the side effect of the technology we all love.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us are going to give up our cars or our computers or our TV sets, but we do have to remember that there's a downside to sitting around all day.
Exactly. The gift is the curse. And regarding your experience with arachnoiditis, it is known as a rare disease by the National Organization for Rare Disorders. For patients who present with pain or other types of debilitating conditions and have these underlying rare conditions, they often go through these experiences in which people do not consider their pain as legitimate, or they have trouble convincing other physicians who may not be familiar with arachnoiditis to quote-unquote believe them. So there's always that stigma of disbelief. Can you talk a little bit about how that stigma has evolved over time? Was it as prevalent as it is now? And what are some key trends that you've noticed?
Well, I think first off, and you and I are physicians, and we can self-admit that when we don't know what the issue is, we tend to disbelieve the patient.
I mean, right.
That's kind of human nature, and unfortunately, that's with us. I think as the awareness of cauda inflammation and arachnoiditis, all the lower spine inflammatory conditions, is becoming known, we're tending to believe patients about back pain more and more. And again, physicians are in this position as people who come in and complain about back pain so often just to get disability, to get off work, to get drugs, and what have you. So the complaint of back pain is always met with some suspicion, and today what physicians have to do is go through some protocol that they develop to weed out those who are not legitimate and who just don't have a real disease. But the awareness of inflammatory disorders of the lower spine, of which arachnoiditis is the very worst, is becoming known. And it's going through its usual courses of awareness and diagnosis and now treatment. So we're making headway, but we've got a ways to go.
Yeah, and where do you see the greatest opportunity for growth, the greatest immediate benefit that we can afford patients with this condition?
I think the progress with this condition is this. We don't quite know whether it should still be called a rare condition or not, maybe an unusual condition when you compare it to diabetes or hypertension or asthma. But it's in every community, in every medical practice. And so it's common enough now that every community and every primary care physician is going to have to know about it. And they're certainly starting to understand that on how it develops and what it is. And I think the other thing that's happening is that the tools today to diagnose it are here. The MRI was discovered in 1987. And since that time, the technology of the MRI has come forward, progressively getting better by the year, it seems like. And it's my contention, for example, today, that every nurse practitioner and every primary care doctor ought to be able to read a lumbar MRI that's done with contrast.
Mm-hmm.
You can look right in there. And it's as easy to look at as a fracture of a bone or a chest x-ray. And it's also very interesting. And so I think that the contrast MRI of the lumbar sacral spine is changing how we look at people and how we're going to practice medicine. It's again, you talk about technology. That's a little bit of technology that is really going to separate out those people who have legitimate back problems, those who need surgery, those who need medicine. So it's been a wonderful advance.
Well, that's really interesting you mentioned that and the role of technology and educating physicians, both the primary care and hospitalist physicians of the world. That one of the issues that we encounter that you may be especially familiar with is this kind of a paradox in what is cleared by insurance and what is good clinical care. So, for example, if a patient presents with pain, they have a migraine, they have a potential associated symptoms that warrant further neurological evaluation, often the insurance companies will require us to either undergo an x-ray first or require us to go through a prior authorization process to get the MRI clearance. What you're suggesting is that increased number of MRIs as part of the evaluation earlier than later may help to identify and diagnose this condition sooner than later and provide better quality of care. Is that an accurate way to assess your position? And if so, how would you then refute some of the difficulties physicians like myself have with insurance companies?
Yeah, well, I think first off, it's interesting we're having this conversation today. It's only been about 10 days ago that we went through, I've been collecting data on we've looked at about 1,000 MRIs of myocarditis patients, and we've got very good computerized data on a number of a few hundred arachnoiditis patients. And what I'm pleased to announce is that we've got the symptom criteria that points to the disease. Turns out that adhesive arachnoiditis has a rather specific clinical profile, and it's really quite interesting. And I think if you have this clinical profile, our position is you need a contrast MRI. A simple plain old x-ray of the spine is not going to tell you much, other than that you might have a terrible disc problem. But these five criteria are real simple. You know, it's constant pain, the radiation of the buttocks or legs, they get better when they stand or lay down. And interestingly enough, these arachnoiditis patients have some other symptoms you wouldn't think about. I was surprised that they have them. First off, they all have bladder problems. They can't start, stop, or hold their urine. And then the two that are very interesting, they all have burning feet. It's really interesting. Their feet burn. And the big one is, which was quite a shock to me when I got into all of this, they all have periodic sensations of either water dripping or insects crawling on their legs. And this is because the nerve roots get trapped in this mass. They caught a kind of nerve roots and the arachnoid kind of get glue stuck together and they end up with these odd sensations. And so 80% of patients will have those specific symptoms. And I think that where we can make a lot of mileage is when physicians and nurse practitioners and chiropractors, when the medical people that deal with the bad backs learn those symptoms, they'll know that this is that they then can look forward a little further to what the causes of arachnoiditis may be. But you've then got the profile and the ammunition to fundamentally demand that the insurance companies pay for these things. And I think it'll, if the insurance company's interested in saving money, this is going to save them money, because an awful lot of people are going to be able to avoid a lot of needless surgery, a lot of needless intervention, and they'll be able to be managed in a general primary care office, which is where it needs to be managed.
That's an interesting point that you mentioned, that because there are studies documenting financial cost savings to both the patients and to the insurance companies for early intervention and diagnosis of arachnoiditis. You seem to allude that insurance companies, and I think I mentioned this earlier, insurance companies are the ones that really need to start to cover this MRI, diagnostic MRI, sooner than later. But do you also see that perhaps changing the way primary care physicians in inpatient and outpatient settings, hospitalists, look at patients presenting with this condition is also needed as well? And how would you go about educating physicians in that world?
Real very simply, and that is one of the other very interesting and very critical research bits of knowledge that's come down the pike recently, is that discs that herniate or discs that protrude or slip are inflamed, and the inflammation on the disc will spread right on to the dura arachnoid layer, on into the caudoequina, and cause an inflammatory condition in the lower spine.
Mm-hmm.
But this understanding that those discs are inflamed and that the inflammation will spread, just like cellulitis on the face or the arm, is critical. And that really is the major mechanism of this today. There are other causes of arachnoiditis that are probably genetically based because they've got one of these Ehlers-Danlos collagen disorders. But the understanding that discs that become slipped are inflamed and that the inflammation will spread into the spinal canal is what it's all about. And it's a very simple concept. It's taken, you know, research to come up with these simple concepts that are applicable and knowable by every medical student, chiropractor, nurse practitioner, and physician. And I think that it's just simple understanding will bring about the change.
Awareness and understanding are critical, and I commend you on your efforts in raising awareness and the broader medical community about this. One of the things that's very fascinating about your career, and there are quite a few fascinating and impressive achievements that you've accomplished, one of the most fascinating components is your Facebook group, in which you focus on raising awareness for patients who have been diagnosed with arachnoiditis or intractable pain syndromes. While it's an informational purposes only, the group is a very strong launching board for patients to learn about their potential conditions. Can you talk a little bit about some of the benefits you've been able to provide patients informationally, and any examples in which those patients, after learning certain concepts in your Facebook group, were able to talk to their physicians?
Sure. Let me tell you another thing that has occurred in medicine. The good and bad and ugly of it, and that is it's become top-heavy.
Yeah.
And what do I mean by that? In the past, I spent most of my career in the good information came from the top down, meaning, you know, it started off in the universities, moved on into the professional organizations, into the journals, into the CME courses. Now, all of that today has become so huge, so financially dependent, so controversial, and it's blocked. For example, I recall back when I was a young physician, and I published an article in, for example, the Archives of Internal Medicine, and the whole world would know about that article within a week. Today, there are probably 200 to 300 peer-reviewed journals out there. There are so many peer-reviewed journals that there are no journals.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
Yeah, so, and so publishing in medical journals, I started to find out, even when I was an editor of Practical Pain Management for a dozen years, over that dozen years, I saw that for the time I decided I've got to find a better way of communicating, by the time I'd gone through those 12 years, our ability to do influencing of people diminished.
Right.
Simply because all of a sudden, you know, when you're one journal out there and all of a sudden there's 12, well, nobody reads any of them.
Information overload.
Information overload, exactly. And so what's happening today is we have to have new ways to communicate. You're obviously a big part of it right now. And the other thing is that physicians have got so busy that there's been a change in attitude among the physicians. It used to be that patients come in and tried to tell the doctor something about the disease. We all got our backs up and we all resented that. Today, when a patient comes in with an article or something, I say, oh, well, guys, let me see that. You know?
Yeah.
So we've had this change, which I think is really kind of, it's kind of happy and cute, and but it works. Patients should know that if they will collect information and take it to their doctor, unless the doctor gets some buddy you don't want anything to do with, is going to be very grateful you got this information. So what I have learned that I can write all the peer review articles, but if I put something out and tell all the patients, put these on your Facebook groups and have them take it to their doctors, all of a sudden we start to get people educated. And one of the great things that's happening, you can say a lot of criticism about the medical system is it's so big, so huge, so bureaucratic, and dysfunctional, as everybody knows. But there are, we still have in every community very caring doctors and nurse practitioners. We have, good local hospitals that still care. So we've still got an awful lot of caring out there. People kind of forgot that. And but we're sort of all in this together. Doctors in communities, they're not making the money they used to. They don't have the prestige they used to. But the care is still out there.
Right.
And it's good care. I think the physicians today are far better than when I was in my early life and career. So there's a lot of good things going on. Everybody looks at it pretty negatively. But the Facebook groups, all I've done is, since I hardly know how to operate a bunch, the patients that can, I've said, I'll get you information every week. I'll get you some bulletins, some chronicles, some papers, and you guys go out there and teach everybody you can. And every time I send out an email to somebody, I say, every patient who's got a disease like arachnoiditis or even diabetes or any other critical issue, they need to join the Facebook groups and the social groups that are spreading that information. Nothing wrong with that, and certainly the physicians today know that they can take advantage of it in the sense that the patients can be better educated.
Exactly. Now, can you give me an example of something positive and an example in which maybe things could have been communicated a little bit more effectively through your Facebook group? Let me give you an example. For example, let's say there's a patient who comes in to the Facebook group with the diagnosis, a recent diagnosis of arachnoiditis, and based upon the information you provide, he or she is able to better communicate with the physician. That ideally would be the goal. And I'm sure, as a matter of fact, I know that has happened quite often on your Facebook group. But I would imagine that a Facebook group having so many diverse individuals, being a little bit less controlled than an academic journal, there's going to be a range of experiences. Can you allude to something that went well and something that I think in hindsight you probably could have improved upon?
Very much so. First off, I was a little reluctant early on to encourage patients to talk to physicians so aggressively. When physicians like you and I are we're a little uncertain ourselves. I think we transmit that uncertainty in big time to patients.
Yep.
And I wasn't certain it was the way to go. But what I have learned is that I need to be much more firm and say, spread the word. You know, take this to your physicians and also tell the physician where he can get other information. And like on the websites or the reports, like right now I'm getting ready to send something out to I'm putting together a library of 24 MRI images for the primary care nurse practitioner and physician, because they can learn to read. I can teach anybody. I can teach a fifth grader to read these new MRIs. And so that means the physicians might be a little harder. I don't know. But anyway, I think that where I've made my mistake is not preparing information for them in a way that the physician might accept it better. And I was also reticent to encourage patients to do that. But I'm now four square behind patients taking information to their doctors and also letting the doctor know where you could get information. Because let's face it, you've got some doctors today seeing 30, 50 patients a day. They hardly have any time to think. And then all of a sudden somebody comes in with a disease that's got a funny name they've hardly heard of, don't know exactly what to do about it. That busy physician may be very grateful to get that information. So I think it's been more of an attitude on my part as knowing whether the Facebook groups would be constructive and positive and respective of their positions. And I think my fears have been overcome. And so I think it's more been a problem on my part understanding that, yeah, we've got a new system out there, and that is patients and community-based physicians are in this together, and they'll work together. And I think that's one of the greatest things that I've seen lately. And, you know, I don't think it's new. I grew up and was trained in the rural areas of Kansas, and we call that old country medicine. You know, that's all it is.
Yeah.
Country medicine is back, never gone away, and it's still popular. And it's still people living in a community. They're trying to help each other. And so this is just another, it's nothing new, but it is a new tool. But it's a more effective tool.
Right.
It's a faster tool. We don't have to wait for, you know, some peer-reviewed journal to come out with something that would get to the physician, because it may never get to him anyway.
Exactly. No, so one of the things that you sense is the breadth of communication is much more efficient now than it was before, but that same community spirit, the same community ethos of healthcare in its most original form in the United States is now reemerging, just finding a new technological platform.
That's absolutely right. In other words, one of my pet peeves has been that we've continued to have the drive to have everybody go to the big center.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and of course, I was on the UCLA faculty for 25 years, and I certainly spent my time dealing with the prestigious big centers. And I guess we'll still always have a place for that, but medical care has to be done in somebody's local community with the local doctors and the spirit of commonality and helping. It's gone on for thousands of years, and we tried it a different way, but it hasn't worked.
Mm-hmm.
Back to fundamentals. And for example, you take adhesive arachnoiditis. That's another disease like rheumatoid arthritis or like schizophrenia or emphysema that's going to have to be managed over a lifetime. It's got to be done with the local doc and the local patient.
Right. No, I appreciate that, sir. With the remaining time, Dr. Tennant, I would like for you to discuss the Tennant Foundation, what the foundation strives to aim for, and also a little bit about your book, The Strange Medical Saga of Elvis Presley, and how the proceeds from the book will help the Tennant Foundation.
Oh, surely. I'll say this, my wife and I have started off when I was just a young physician back in the 60s, buying real estate and learning to invest in real estate for our retirement. And then we got the retirement age, and then two things happened. Number one was I didn't want to retire. And secondly, I didn't realize that my real estate was going to pay me a lot more money than what I needed to live on. And let me just say this. The concept in America of the family foundation, putting together the money that you've been, God bless, had able to make during your lifetime, and it was more than what you needed to live on, you put it in a foundation and then use that for your favorite causes, is what my wife and I have done. And so we've put together some resources to be able to fund our educational efforts, and we feel very blessed to be able to do this. And that's nothing new either. I mean, physicians have done this throughout history. Those who had the resources tried to do something on a bigger scale. So that's what the Tenet Foundation is about. People who donate or buy our books, the money goes in there to continue our research and education efforts. I will say one thing about Elvis Presley, and I'm also going to add Howard Hughes. Mm-hmm. I was involved in both of those cases after they died, and it involved some litigation. It might surprise people to know that I'm the only person in the United States who happened to have Elvis Presley's medical records and his autopsies and everything about his health care, because after he died, I became involved in defending his doctors and analyzing the cases. In the Howard Hughes case, I was hired by the government to analyze what happened to him, and I have his autopsies and all his what medical records were available. These two books were written for people to not only enjoy, but to record history for these fine people. And but there's also a lot of medical information in there that if you have, intractable pain, you have in Howard Hughes' case, obsessive compulsive disorder, certainly want to look at it. In the case of Elvis Presley, we now know, we didn't know that at the time, but he had something that is called a genetic connective tissue collagen disorder, and also that disorders are commonly referred to these days as Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Hmm.
And
collagen deformation.
Yes, that's why he could do all those moves on stage. We've got a few pictures in the book of him there with him in doing some of his gyrations in odd positions, holding a microphone and singing at the same time. And none of us can do that.
Wow.
But he was, the other thing that I wrote the books for was that these people have been maligned, criticized, their drug taking has been criticized, their lifestyle has been criticized. But they contributed an awful lot to all of us, both these men, and so I have recorded down for historical purposes everything, and in fact, autopsies are included in the book, medical records are included as history books, and certainly you'll find there, you'll have a different view and respect of those two men if you read the books and read what really happened to them from a medical standpoint.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tennant. Thank you for explaining that. And before we conclude, I would just like the audience to know that the book, The Strange Medical Saga of Elvis Presley, is available on Amazon, as well as The Strange Medical Saga of Howard Hughes is also available on Amazon. And I would encourage anybody who has a fascination with medical history to please purchase those books. Not only is it an excellent read, but you're supporting a great cause, which is the Tennant Foundation.
Jay, can I have one last word?
Yes, sir.
Let me compliment what you are doing. You and I know a few other physicians have started their own blogs, their own shows. That technology has allowed us to do this. I think it's dynamite. Keep it up. There's just nothing that patients like today than to hear from a doctor that's actually out there in practice, out there has an interest, out there writing. And that's another a new thing that's helping people at the local level get some help and some care and love and being deterred.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tennant. I appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you.
Okay. Thanks so much. Keep it up.
Okay, will do. Take care now. Have a great day.
Bye.
God bless.